All right, well, thank you for the invitation to come here and to talk. So I wanted to talk about the significance of this gravitational wave measurement of a binary neutron star merger because of its implications for the R process. And so I thought it would be a good idea to go through what the R process is and what the history of thinking about the R process has been, because it's been one of the more controversial aspects of nuclear astrophysics for the last half century. And I don't have to elaborate too much about this gravitational wave observation. It was certainly a unique event in astronomy. It wasn't the first multi-messenger event. That was supernova 1987A, but this event really carried the multi-messenger aspect to unprecedented levels. So it was observed in virtually all wave bands besides the gravitational waves, and in all, you know, over 3,000 astronomers were involved in observations of this event, and considering that there's only 10,000 worldwide, that's a pretty impressive statistic.
That's not exactly right, because most of those were physicists on the paper.
Right.
So there's about 1,000 astronomers or so.
1,000 LIGO people and the rest are
on there as well. So it's a small fraction of that astronomers.
Okay.
All right. 1 in 10 is fine.
Yeah, we got it.
All right. Okay, so sort of a summary of what I want to talk about is that the history of the R process begins with, first of all, the recognition that there is an R process. And so that required accurate determination of isotopic abundances. And secondly, there was the realization that there were two different processes in nature that were involved in the production of very heavy elements through the neutron capture processes, one involving a slow capture of neutrons and the other a rapid capture, hence the S and R names. And then it was short order to determine the thermodynamical and dynamical conditions needed for the R process, and then things moved to the identification of possible sites. So anywhere from the Big Bang to supernovae to compact object mergers have been proposed over the years. Parallel with the rampant astrophysical speculations were vigorous experimental and theoretical efforts from the nuclear physics side to determine the properties of neutron-rich nucleides, including ones far beyond the valley of beta stability, almost to the neutron drip line. There were decades of astrophysical simulations involved in this problem, and a very important development was the realization of the importance of neutrino matter interactions. Astrophysical observations about the R process began with the identification that R process elements were existing in very metal poor and therefore old stars, and but there have been changing theoretical ideas concerning galactic chemical evolution that are involved with this problem as well. There, the discovery of gamma ray bursts and the division of them into short and long gamma ray bursts, and the non-association of the short gamma ray bursts with supernovae, basically made them favored source of these shorter events compact object mergers, simply for the lack of any other suggestions. The development of the kilonova hypothesis as the photon signature of a merger then developed, beginning with Lee and Pachinski and following with Brian Metzger in 2010 and others. And we've had many conferences over the last few years on multi-messenger astronomy that was thought to be one possible outcome of a gravitational wave observation of a merger, although we really didn't, I think that that was going to happen anytime soon. Some short gamma ray burst afterglows are suspected now to be from kilonovae. There have been new observations of radioactive nuclides in the Earth's crust and ocean sediments, in particular plutonium-244, that has also shed a lot of light on this question. And one of the last really significant astrophysical observations was the identification of R process enriched stars in a very small minority of so-called ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. So I'll describe these in more detail. And then finally, there was the observation of the neutron star merger by LIGO and Virgo. So why is this gravitational wave signal measurement so important? Well, first of all, the gravitational wave signal is exactly what was expected from a binary neutron star merger, including the fact that the two stars are apparently similar to 1.4, the canonical 1.4 solar mass neutron stars. This gravitational wave signal was followed within a couple of seconds by a short gamma ray burst from the same location. And the optical and infrared radiation observed from 11 hours to 2 weeks afterwards, the delay of 11 hours was caused by a combination of events, including the lack of a very prompt notification of the event and the fact that we don't have observatories everywhere in the world, and we had to wait for it to be observed in Chile for the first observations. But basically, from the moment that it was possible to be observed, it was observed. And the indications are that a few percent of the total mass involved in the event was ejected at velocity, at relativistic velocities. And furthermore, that this ejected matter created very heavy elements. The X-rays that and radio emission were delayed by a couple of weeks, and this is taken as evidence that the gamma ray burst was observed off-axis, which also accounts for its relative weakness. So I don't want to discuss the optical signatures too much, but I do want to emphasize that the mergers of neutron stars and many of the subsequent observations had in fact been predicted to occur. As a source of short gamma ray bursts, both black hole neutron star and binary neutron star mergers were suspected as the sources. Binary neutron star mergers have been predicted to eject several, anywhere from a hundredth to maybe a tenth of a solar mass in the case of black hole neutron star mergers, and velocities higher than escape velocity were apparent, and so that's velocities greater than c over 10. And nuclear physics calculations have long shown that the subsequent decompression of this matter should synthesize extremely neutron-rich nuclei, particularly the R-process elements. And the gamma rays from the beta decays and fission involved in the synthesis of these heavy elements, and then their resultant beta decays back to the valley beta stability, provide a source of energy to power an afterglow, which would be observed in the optical. And then only recently it was realized that if in fact the R process is being produced, that only a small fraction of the material has to be in the kind of heavy elements known as lanthanides, which have extremely high opacities. And this could then delay the emission for many days and accounts for the duration that was later seen in this in the light curve following the gravitational wave event. So it's really a triumph for astrophysics theory and computational efforts over the years that have explained many of the observations. So evidently, very heavy radioactive nuclei are being synthesized in this event. And why is this important? Well, the origin of the heavy elements has been one of the outstanding nuclear physics questions, and it appears in the decadal survey from nuclear physics, for example, that the origin of the R process is an extremely important question. So it's useful to consider the history of how this question originated and efforts towards its resolution. So the story begins as early as 1889 with Frank Wigglesworth Clark's first determination of abundances of the nuclides from the Earth's crust. And later, from Goldschmidt in Sweden in 1938, you determined abundances for the first time for meteorites. But nuclear physicists basically largely ignored these studies. They were simply too early. It wasn't really until the late 1940s that the nuclear shell model was developed and the significance of magic numbers was realized. So even in the Goldschmidt 1938 abundances, you can see the third, the second, and the first R and S process peaks in the abundance distribution pattern. But this had no significance until the magic numbers were recognized. So the first suggestions that heavy elements were created in supernovae was made by Hoyle around 1946. But at the same time, Alpher and Gamow were pushing this idea that heavy elements actually originate from during the Big Bang. And Hermann later helped refine this idea. And in a very famous paper in which they added Hans Bethe to form the famous alpha beta Gamow paper, they had this suggestion. And in fact, this the previous figure here using the Goldschmidt abundances was used in their paper. So this is taken from the Gamow alpha beta Gamow paper. And this calculated curve just shows a model that they used from the Big Bang to predict how the neutron captures might produce these heavy elements. So Susan Urey compiled a further table of abundances using both the Earth's crust and meteorites and solar abundances for the first time to make a more refined table. And so this is an example of their results. They actually published different figures in addition to this, which showed how the abundances vary as a function if you only take odd nuclei or if you take even nuclei. And so the abundance pattern by nuclei is actually fairly choppy, revealing an odd-even effect. But if you plot just the odd abundances or the even abundances, the abundance pattern is very smooth. So Coriel at MIT in 1956 first suggested that these two peaks must arise from different rates of neutron capture associated with the magic numbers. And the continuity of the odd-even abundances indicates that there's a universality to the process. So this was just a year before the famous B squared FH paper. And so the idea that we now think is the correct one can be seen here. So this is a chart of the nuclei with proton fraction and a proton number and neutron number plotted. The stable elements are illustrated as these black squares. And the S process path, the slow capture of neutrons, basically follows a long stable nuclei, but can't produce all of the nucleides. And so if we take a section of this chart this sort of part of the mass table here, we can see that the S process path follows this blue line. You keep adding neutrons to stable nuclei until you get to an unstable one. And then the capture of neutrons is so slow that this nucleus will beta decay to a stable nucleus, where it will capture eventually another neutron and then beta decay. And then so this curve follows the stable nucleides. But that leaves some of these nuclei on the bottom and on the top not possible to be formed in this way. So there's believed to be a P process that occurs possibly in explosions on neutron star surfaces or white dwarfs that produces these proton-rich nuclei. And then a different kind of neutron capture process, the R process, that can produce these very heavy nuclei. So in the R process, the capture of neutrons is so fast that the nuclei formed are very, very far away from the valley of beta stability, almost at the neutron drip line. And so the neutron captures proceed very quickly, carrying you up in mass number until you get to the neutron magic numbers, particular 82 here. Then the neutron captures are not possible to occur on the relevant timescales because of the closed shell effect. And so the nuclei wait there and beta decay. And as they beta decay, you add a proton, and then you can add another neutron to get back to the magic number. And you just follow this until you beta decay close enough to the valley of beta stability that the neutron capture cross-section becomes high enough that the neutron captures proceed again, and that carries you up to the next magic number, where again you wait along here and then continue up. So as nuclei are being formed on the R process, there are relatively low abundances in between magic numbers, high abundances here and here, but you know, low in between. And then when the nuclei beta decay after the R process is over, they'll go from this here on a 45 degree line and basically produce an abundance peak several, you know, 10 or 15 units lower than the magic number would be, which produces an abundance peak associated with the S process. Again, there's a weighting of S process elements as well along the magic numbers. So we expect the existence of these two peaks, and that explains then the observations. And that's why a rapid and a slow process were believed to be involved. And the difference in the rates, the neutron capture rates in these events are something like 15 orders of magnitude. So they're really quite distinct events or situations. So knowing, for example, that the S process occurs as a result of the capture of neutrons slowly and the R process capturing them rapidly means that we can use known nuclear information to be able to distinguish between the S process and R process in an individual nuclide. So some nuclides are produced by both, some only by the R process and some only by the S process. So this shows then a detailed chart of by mass number of the abundances on a log scale. You can see the odd-even effects, and the red and the blue shows how theoretically then we can disentangle the observed abundance patterns into just those associated with the S process and those associated with the R process. And so you see the peaks for the R process are 10 or 15 units below the magic numbers associated with the S process peak in all three of these cases. So just prior to the publication of the famous B squared FH, Burbridge, Fowler, and Hoyle paper in 1957, there was a foray into trying to explain the abundances, the formation of heavy elements that stemmed from observations by Bode et al. In 1956 that suggested that, in fact, supernova light curves of type 1, the type we now associate with white dwarf explosions, have a roughly 55 decay exponential decay character. And the discovery of californium 254 in the Bikini-Abon test, which was found to have roughly the same half-life. I think we now know that that's 51 days, I think, instead of 55. But at any rate, the coincidence of these two timescales and giving the timing strongly suggested to them that that in fact it was type 1 supernovae that must make heavy elements, because if you make californium 254, you must make the other heavy elements as well. And so this is what showed up then in 1957 in their B squared FH paper. They did associate supernovae with the R process, but in particular, only type 1 supernovae. And the type 2 supernovae, which are observed in star-forming regions and are associated with more massive stars, even that was known at the time, that they make the bulk of the iron. So Cameron resisted this, realizing that type 1 supernovae must be associated with an old population and therefore light progenitor cores, and they won't collapse to high densities, he argued. So he thought they got it backwards and that our process elements must originate in type 2 supernovae, and type 1 supernovae are responsible for the production of iron. Hoyle and Fowler moved on and decided that no, maybe supermassive stars of 10,000 solar masses or greater made the R process. And there was so much debate, some of it pretty acrimonious, about the source of the R process that a lot of focus was shifted, especially with Willie Fowler's group, to looking at the nuclear data for neutron-rich nuclei. Seeger, Fowler, and Clayton in 1965 had suggested that the R process operates in a gamma N equilibrium, and they showed that it's not possible to make all three R process peaks in the same event at constant temperature and density. And Cameron and Truen and Schramm showed that in fact the R process could occur in a single event if there was a dynamically expanding neutron-rich medium, and then all three peaks could be created. So David Schramm was my thesis advisor. And he suggested that, looking for sources for the R process, that we investigate the mergers of neutron stars in binaries that will occur because of the orbital decay due to gravitational radiation. And, of course, David was a very risk-averse person. He climbed the highest mountain in all the continents except Asia. And he was a spelunker and was a rugby aficionado and was on the Caltech wrestling team and later coached the wrestling team, and there was a possibility he could have been on the Olympic squad, but decided not to so that he could finish his PhD. And so he proposed that we investigate neutron star mergers, but I thought this is a pretty formidable problem to do in general relativity, and so I changed the project to looking at a black hole being a background and having a neutron star spiral in and be tidally disrupted, thinking that that was possibly a more reliable calculation. And anyway, our conclusions were pretty general. The tidal effects were so strong that the impulses provided to the material during the last couple of orbits would be more than enough to achieve relativistic velocities for a significant fraction of the total mass, especially coming from equatorial regions. And so we proposed that up, you know, somewhere around 0.05, I think we used 0.05 plus or minus 0.05 to cover all the bases that of the amount of mass that would be ejected. And then it seemed clear in this work and later works that it would very likely form our process nuclei. And furthermore, if you take about 0.05 solar masses per merger, and population studies can be used to show that neutron star mergers are probably 1,000th to 1/10,000th as frequent as supernovae. And if you multiply those two rates together, you would get the observed abundances of our process nuclei. So it's a fairly speculative idea, and I hadn't realized fully the true speculative nature of this idea. It wasn't until recently, when I went back and looked at the timing of everything, that I realized that Schramm proposed the project well long before Hulson-Taylor discovered the first neutron star in a binary neutron star system. The binary pulsar was actually discovered in July of 74 and only realized to be in a binary in September of 74, and their paper was submitted in October 74 and published in 75, but our paper was published before their paper was actually submitted. So Schramm actually had no inkling that they had discovered a system like this, and which I had thought might have been the case why he proposed the problem. So. So we had a couple of follow-up studies before we more or less walked away, at least I walked away from the problem for a number of years. We did a more detailed simulation of the merger using Chandrasekhar's ellipsoidal figures of equilibrium book to model neutron stars as concentric shells of various densities, again, treating the neutron star in a tidal field of a black hole. And then we looked at the nuclear physics in more detail in this paper with Fred Mackey and Jeff Ravenhall, in which we studied the decompression. And this is a figure taken from the paper. And the basic idea is that when you release a bit of neutron star matter from supernuclear densities, it will expand because the minimum stable neutron star mass is about 0.1 solar masses. So in the disruption, you create all these pockets of much smaller masses, so they will have to explosively decompress. And as they expand and go below the nuclear saturation density, the protons want to cluster on a very rapid time scale. And so you'll form very heavy nuclei at whatever happens to be the proton magic number under these very neutron-rich conditions. So we use Z of 50, but more modern calculations seem to show that the proton magic number under those conditions will be probably closer to 30. At any rate, you will expand at constant proton number because there's not enough time for any beta decays to occur. And as you expand, the nuclei shed neutrons like crazy. So they go from having neutron numbers of close, you know, several hundred over here down to maybe 100 as you get down here. And finally, we get close enough to the valley beta stability, beta decays will start, and you'll start adding neutrons, and you'll follow these paths. These different paths are the relative time scales between beta decays and neutron captures. The expansion rate in beta decays. And it's pretty much independent of what the beta decay rates will be, which, you know, we were guessing at. you would go up to fission, where you then create, if symmetric fission products would carry you way down here, but otherwise you would produce a whole bunch of nuclei spread out, and then they'll capture more neutrons, go up to fission, and you'll cycle. And then when the process is done, these nuclei beta decay back to the valley of beta stability. So it seemed kind of obvious this was what had to happen, and that you wouldn't make light nuclei in this event, but only heavy nuclei, and the heavy nuclei you would make would have to be our process. Well, almost nobody believed this scenario. The favored site for the R process has long been supernovae. We do know that whatever makes the R process, it's universal. So the later discovery of the R process in metal-poor stars, both in our galaxy and in nearby dwarf galaxies, have the same relative R process abundances that we see in the solar system. And so whatever's making it, it's making it with equal relative abundances, suggesting just one source. And if you do connect the R process with supernovae, then only a hundred thousandth of a solar mass has to be made in each supernova to explain observed abundances. And so the connection between neutron star mergers as being a source, the biggest problem is always had is the relatively long time delay that must occur between the supernova events that creates the neutron stars and their eventual merger, which could be 10 or 100 million years or even longer. And the observations that metal-poor stars, even the stars with the least amount of metals that we know of, typically they all have also R process elements in them already. That seems difficult to reconcile with its time delay. On the other hand, there is an extremely large scatter in the R process abundances in very metal-poor stars, and that doesn't seem to favor a continuous production of R process, you know, small amount in very rapid events, but rather a rare high-yield event.
And those two, it almost seems like you're saying contradictory things there, but I think in the second statement there, you're saying that
second from the bottom,
the second from the top, mm-hmm. it's the relative numbers that are the same, but in the bottom you're saying then the overall normalization changes. Is that?
That's right. Okay. That's right.
I got a similar. So in other words, when you write relative R process abundances, those are relative within the R process.
Yes.
Relative to something.
So here's some metal poor stars, and you can see that the black line are solar system abundances. And so in detail, the R process abundance is determined by observation with really very, very small error bars now, match the solar system R process abundance in virtually every star that's studied. Now, there are a couple of exceptions, and some of these don't match, okay? But the number of nuclei that don't match is very, very
And the relative
small.
Number on the bottom is that if you take that bottom star relative to the top star, that
they're all shifted. Yeah. So this is a relative abundances. They're all been shifted just to the solar system pattern is the same in each case. We just shifted it up and down for clarity. So this doesn't mean that this star has a low overall R process abundance and this one has a high one. It's just they're just shifted for clarity. There. But the R process scatter decreases with metallicity. So the more metal abundant you are, you go from left to right here. So this notation means the iron to hydrogen abundance in the star relative to what's observed in the sun in log base 10 units. So this means that heavy elements like iron and oxygen are 10% as abundant in these stars as in the sun. 1% is abundant, 1/10 of a percent is abundant, and over on the extreme left, 1/10,000th of the abundance that's observed in the sun. So, in general, you would think that the more metal poor a star is, the older it must be, so that somehow time sort of tracks this plot going backwards. And so these are, zero represents solar abundances representing today, and this represents the past. As you go further into the past, presumably, the scatter is definitely increasing. So when you put this into a chemical equilibrium study, which many people have done, the time delay between supernovae and mergers seem to be inconsistent with the abundances that are observed. So this shows what happens if you assume that core collapse supernovae produce the R process. And the black dots are the predicted abundances of a population of stars. Vertical axis is on a logarithmic scale is the abundance of barium as a typical, at least the amount of barium produced by the R process. And the horizontal axis is basically the metallicity. And so the red dots are observations. And so the general predicted abundance patterns given by the black dots kind of match fairly well the observed abundances, but neutron star mergers don't match because of this time delay. And it takes so much time for a typical merger, 10 to 100 million years, that stars are already fairly metal rich before the R process kicks in.
But Jim, just to be clear, I mean, what you're really arguing, right? So we're ready to do binary evolution, there is no minimum time delay. So this is really a historical.
Yes. Population synthesis, you could make it up so that you have virtually no time delay in some systems. And
basically, today we don't talk about time delay for these kind of systems, and you're just making the case of why, right?
Well, historically, this is what has been done. So
I
think
argue with the history here.
This calculation assumed an optimistic case of 10 million years for that time delay, which is fairly short.
But it can be as prompt as you want. There's no.
That's one.
We know that massive stars are in binaries. We know that they're all interacting. So
that's right.
I don't believe there should be any minimum time limit.
So anyway, over the years, there've been a lot of proposed sites. Most of them connected with supernovae. Supernova shocks were suggested by Colgate in '71. Hoyle and Clayton suggested novae. Schramm himself suggested only. At the same time we're writing our other papers, he's suggesting. Well, there's an end process occurring in novae or supernova shocks. The interesting idea that magnetohydrodynamic instabilities in rapidly rotating supernovae was suggested by LeBlanc and Wilson. Schramm and Barkat and Meyer followed this up with looking at R process yields that might occur in those events. Then there's shock processing in helium supernova zones. And then sort of a model that I think is the most favored supernova source is a high entropy neutrino driven wind. But this has run into difficulties once people realize that the neutrino matter interactions tend to generally increase the proton fraction in the ejecta, and you would need really high entropies in order to make this process work. So the supernova have been a continuing set of frustrations in terms of accommodating the production of the R process, and the difficulties producing a high neutron to seed nucleus ratio, which requires extremely high temperatures and or very, very low proton fractions. And the low proton fractions seem to be ruled out by neutrino because of neutrino interactions. So the neutrino-driven wind idea is, I think, the currently most investigated scenario. But there is also some work on progenitors that are rapidly rotating with strong magnetic fields. In any case, it does seem from observations that have been accumulating, that I'll detail in a minute, that whatever the event is involved, it probably doesn't involve all supernovae, because you need to create a significant amount of material in the R process per event, not 1/100,000th of a solar mass, but you need something that's rare. That explains the scatter. So a significant change occurred in the 2000s with the development of the idea that galaxies aren't really closed boxes or even boxes with infill. But they're actually formed from small pieces in a hierarchical type of formation. So what essentially this does is it destroys the relationship between metallicity and time. So you can no longer assume that a low metallicity object is old. And because the star-forming history in each of these small pieces is going to be much, much different. So the observed early appearance of our process elements and their large abundance dispersions in metal-poor stars can be explained, even if the time delays are large. So when you take these new kinds of chemical evolution models, and you can now match the observed R process abundances in metal-poor stars, again shown with barium on the y-axis and iron on the x-axis, and now these colors basically represent the population density of or the density in these two dimensions for these population synthesis models, and they tend to match more or less, at least better than the previous simulations did, which show a drop off at this point. And so these tend to work in a general sense. And there's still a lot of controversy about this picture and about the mixing time scales and so on. So the connection between short gamma ray bursts and mergers, although hypothetical for a long time, was put on a more solid basis with observational evidence from SWIFT linking the short gamma ray bursts with mergers, namely their identification as being located primarily in elliptical galaxies and no associated supernovae with these events, as opposed to the long gamma ray burst, where a number of them have been connected with supernovae. And this has held up over the last decade or more. A significant development in the last few years was the discovery of plutonium-244 in the crust and in ocean sediments. Previous work had basically indicated the abundance of plutonium was small, but only could provide upper limits. And now we have a definite amount that we can use. If you assume that plutonium-244 is an R-process element, was produced from all supernovae, you would expect that the abundance we would observe on the Earth today is in this range. So the idea is that supernovae make R-process elements, they get incorporated in dust. The dust gets carried into the solar system on a continuous basis. It filters through the atmosphere and gets incorporated in sediments so that the Earth is constantly being enriched by our process elements. And so the idea, this is a nice blackboard diagram by Svi Perron, basically shows if you have very frequent production of elements that decay, that the abundance, if the nuclei are created frequently enough and you observe at any random time, you're basically going to tend to observe a fairly high abundance of that radioactive element. But if the abundance is produced in a very rare event, high yield rare event, with a long time between events, it's more likely that when you observe, you could observe a high abundance, if you were lucky, I guess, but on average, you'd expect to observe a very low abundance. And since the observed abundances are a factor of 10 to 100 below what you get from a continuous supernova production, this is evidence, strong evidence in favor of the R process being produced in a high yield rare event. So that doesn't rule out supernovae, it just says that if it is supernovae, it has to be a very small fraction of them. Leon Pachinski did the initial work on suggesting that in the aftermath of a short gamma ray burst of a merger, that ejected material would eventually appear as an optical afterglow. And later work by Brian Metzger and collaborators followed this idea up. And then the realization very recently by Barnes and Kaysen and Tanaka and Hotokazawa showed that even a small admixture of lanthanide elements, which have opacities hundreds or thousands of times that of iron, would be enough to delay the emission so that it would then appear as infrared after a week time scale instead of on timescales of hours or days. And so the first event of this type that was a possibility was this event, GRB 130603 in 1913, where you see the afterglow from the event, which has then disappeared. And it's so this is just one point, and but it's well above the what you would expect if you didn't have this late time emission. So it was very highly suggestive of this kilonova-like feature. And I think people are tending toward calling these kilonovae as opposed to the other word macronovae, because the total energy involved does seem to be about 1,000 times that of a, or the amount of luminosity does seem to be about 1,000 times that expected from a nova explosion. And so there may have been a couple of more events of this type, although that's also controversial. A very significant development then in the last couple of years has been the discovery of our process elements in an ultra-faint dwarf galaxy. So the idea is that we have regular galaxies. We have dwarf galaxies, which are, 1,000 times smaller than a galaxy, and then ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, which are another factor of 1,000 less massive. And if we look at the chart over here, this shows the amount of mass in each of these galaxies, ultra-faint dwarf galaxies and dwarf galaxies, as a function of their power output in units of solar luminosity. So if there's continuous supernovae in these systems, you expect that the brighter the system, the more stars there are, and the more supernova there's going to be, the more iron production is going to be, and that matches this very well, and they all line up on the same curve. So supernovae seem to be occurring continuously in these systems at the same rate per mass of galaxy. If we plot the europium as an R process element as a function of luminosity, we see that the same kind, similar pattern holds for the dwarf galaxies, that the brighter the galaxy, the more massive it is, the more R process elements there are, and it follows this sort of linear trend. But then when we look at the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, of all the systems that were studied here, only one, Reticulum 2, had observed R-process abundances. All of these are upper limits, and so therefore suggestive of no R-process elements. And the R-process elements observed in Reticulum 2, some of the stars are shown here, and again you see the same characteristic abundance pattern relative to solar system abundances. And so this shows the particular case, the red circles are the reticulum 2 abundances, barium and europium, as a function of metallicity. And so all of the other ultra-faint dwarf observations are just upper limits. And reticulum 2 has the only positively identified within observational errors that of the R process. So the story that seems to be unfolding is that in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, there have been no mergers, or at least the rare event that produces the R process, except in one of them, one out of 10.
But wouldn't the R process escape? It's like going at 0.1c in a tiny galaxy.
There are. I think this all has to be worked out yet.
Yeah, the escape velocity from these is 8 to 10 kilometers.
Yeah, and these are moving very fast, yes.
And they have, well, 1,000 stars, obviously, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, how does it
hold on to? Well, these are presently the remaining low-mass stars that are observed as giants.
From the number of stars in these galaxies and the observed amount of R process in each star, you get the total abundance is several hundredths of a solar mass. So if the material can be stopped and retained in those dwarf galaxies, then the picture holds together. So there are problems with this, but clearly it's indicating that whatever's producing the R process is happening only rarely in these systems. So that's somehow the important point.
I mean, in some sense, Andrew, you could ask the same question about the iron.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Unless you think that iron was there, unless you think the iron was there out of the... So the question is, was it out of the forming cloud? Or was it something that happened within the cloud from the burst of stars that made that you, mm-hmm. that you see today, right? So these ultra faint, but that's the question.
But the iron is moving at a much lower velocity than that.
It's still higher than escape velocity.
Escape velocity is infinite still.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Escape velocity isn't the relevant parameter. It's the amount, right? Because you shock it with the gas, so it's the gas density around it that really determines it.
Yeah, and the iron is in the centers of supergravity, where it's really much slower than at the outside, so you have a lot of time to keep it hanging around.
So this is certainly a subject under active discussion and controversy, but it is another indication that whatever's producing the R process, it is a rare event because it didn't happen in these systems and did in only one of them.
That's interesting because what you're not plotting and doing it real time mm-hmm. is you're opening the iron. So the coma mm-hmm. in Ursa Majoris 2 on the left plot are the ones which are most iron rich. Right? On the right plot, they have the lower mm-hmm. upper limit. And vice versa for reticulum.
Yeah, I took these figures from this paper, and you're right. It could be, the Europian iron would be an interesting one to show, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And reticulum two, it was multiple stars. Right. How much more do you have?
Right, just another slide or two. Okay. So that's basically... So this happened just prior to the gravitational wave event. So Z is also, so the idea that you need a certain amount per event and then a rate of those events to match observed or process abundances, you have to lie along one of these lines depending on what you assume about the chemical evolution history and the rate as a function of time. And from the estimates of the rate from the LIGO event, which is this number plus a generous error bar, but this is again only based on one event, so I'll take it with a grain of salt. That basically produces, from the inferred amount of mass ejected, that produces a result somewhere in this square, which is actually too good to be true, in a sense. But if you look at the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies on this plot, that gives you somewhere in these purple contours. The plutonium 244 measurement gives you a constraint that lies in this bluish rectangular region, so forth. Everything seems to line up roughly in this sort of area. So the indications are that the amount of mass ejected from the looking at ultra-faint dwarfs in the plutonium are consistent with the observed abundances if the amount of ejecta in each event is somewhere between 1/100 and 1/10, and that's precisely what we see in this particular event. So, yes?
Is assuming 100% conversion between the ejecta mass and R process elements?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, then this is a suggestion. If the problem is indeed solved, we can now identify every element and the fraction of each element with a particular source, where now merging neutron stars would be a very large source of the heavy elements. So basically a summary then is of the importance of this gravitational wave event, not only confirming the association with short gamma ray bursts with mergers, but the definite indications of the production of very heavy neutron-rich elements from the event. And coupling the merger rate with the inferred ejecta mass is more than sufficient to explain all of the observed R process abundances in the solar system. And perhaps we've at last solved this long-standing mystery concerning the source of the R process elements. So, okay.
Of the argument here was that the events were rare, and you've got this number that,
right.
You know, there's 1,000 supernovae per neutron star merger. And you have a twiddle there, you know, kind of.
Yeah, that means factor of 10, I guess, you know.
So I'm just wondering how well we know the neutron star merger. And from a slide or two back here, I mean, you were showing the short duration gamma ray bursts. You had a number for them, and then you had this plot. So that's.
Yeah, so this is a theoretical compact binary merger rate from population synthesis, and the dashed line is
I mean, that's considerably less than, that's like half a dec. Mm-hmm. And so that's the best number for the neutron star, merger?
Yeah, this is taken from a slide by Svi Peron, so I don't know in detail what he assumed.
And what drives that error? Is it like the beaming or something? Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beaming is a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's occurring. What you see is what you get rate. Right? That's no beaming rate. So there's not a lot of beaming in the short GRBs. So there's usually there is a correction, but it's not like a factor of 100. It's not a crazy correction.
Do we know anything about how that rate then changes or doesn't change with metallicity? Just because mm-hmm. the binary fractions and purities and things.
Yeah, I think a lot of the errors are so small numbers, and even a small fraction that's actually followed the redshift.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder from redshifts and hosts and things, is there any hint of a metallicity?
I don't think so. I think short GRB hosts, there are very few studies, and there don't seem to be any trends in metallicity or mass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you take, imagine there's some neutrons on a neutron star and you get totally disrupted. How big are these seed nuclei then? Can you take us from that to the final R process element? Like, what happens and how do these things get together? You mentioned a little bit about it, but.
Yeah, so this picture is generally what happens. I mean, there'll be a distribution, of course, and so I'm just talking about some sort of average nucleus here, but it will leave the neutron star and the nuclear timescales, except the beta decay time. The weak interaction timescales are long, but the strong interaction timescales are short, so.
And by short, let's be clear, 10 to the minus 13 seconds.
Yeah, very.
Just for the observers to understand.
Okay.
It's really, 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 really short.
Right, so as soon as the matter falls below nuclear saturation density, it ceases to be a uniform gas of 95% neutrons and 5% protons, and the protons will cluster. And they'll make a heavy nucleus, of which you'll also have drip neutrons outside, but half the matter will be in nuclei, half the matter will be in neutrons. These nuclei will have proton numbers in the range of 30 to 50, and the neutron numbers will be in the range of several hundred, you know, 500 or 300, 700. Depends on the mass model, you know, the nuclear symmetry energy and other details of the nuclear force. But in no case will there be small nuclei, they'll be huge. But as they expand, you'll go to lower densities, and at lower densities, the nuclear equilibrium shifts to having a smaller neutron to proton ratio in the nuclei. So those extra neutrons flood out of the nuclei and join the other neutrons that are already there. And this continues until you get closer to the valley beta stability, when beta decays can start and you build up the proton number. And each time you add a proton, you grab a couple of neutrons out because
there's. Jim, I think it would be helpful to also at the same time give people a sense of where the fluid element is, right? So from the far right to the left corner, mm-hmm. right, the amount of time elapsed is.
Yeah, there's several things you could show, what the average density is along the path or the elapsed time along the path.
Right, but for the beta decays to start becoming relevant, you need a time scale. I mean, they're fast beta decays, so maybe you're down to 10 seconds or maybe a few minute beta decays, right?
Right.
So by that point, if you ask where the material is, mm-hmm. it's been moving at C over 3 for a second.
Yes.
So I mean, just to help people with.
Right. Yeah. But it's only a matter of seconds. I mean, it's instantaneous on the time scale of observing a light curve or anything else.
Right.
And the whole R process is over in just a couple of seconds.
Yeah, sorry, so I interrupted your
flow. No, but that's fine. But so the idea is that these nuclei get smaller and smaller until you get here, and then they start to get bigger and bigger. And once you get on this path, you basically go up to fission and if there's enough neutrons left after you fission, you keep capturing more. And depending on the overall conditions, the densities and temperatures that are assumed, you can fission and cycle a few times, or you maybe just fission once, or, you know, it's depends on the particular scenario, the density temperature history there. But if you have a lot of cycling, then it's very easy to produce all three peaks. If you have basically no cycling, where you get up to fission, maybe in some of the nuclei fission, but not all of them, then you generally would tend to make a lot of the first peak down here, but not the second and third peaks at larger neutron numbers. Yeah.
So our observations indicate that at early times there were not very many of the heavy R process
exactly.
elements observed, but then the later times there are. So it could be that there's two different sites we're seeing, or it could be that it's spherically symmetric, and on the outside we have the lighter stuff, and on the inside the heavier stuff.
The ejecta that we observe it first because it is high YE material, and it's hot. It's come from the shearing of the neutron stars in the final stages, and that evidently comes out mostly in the polar direction. And because it's got a very low opacity, we're going to see it first. And the stuff coming out on the tidal tail, and later by the neutrino wind pushing material out of the disk, is going to be a lower proton fraction material and a higher opacity material, and we're not going to see that until later. So the idea that the blue ejecta comes first is primarily a result of the fact that it has a low opacity due to the composition, that it's very very high proton fraction material, you know, 0.3 or 0.4 protons per nucleon. And this comes because it's produced in a very high temperature environment, as opposed to the tidal ejecta and the disk outflow, which is initially lower temperature and therefore higher neutron fraction.
Yeah, I understand that. Predominant view is. But you know what I'm asking is, could you make a spherically symmetric model that has the same effects as what we see? I mean, we've actually compared it to a spherically symmetric model. It seems to be okay. And there's spectrophotometry, which is consistent with being spherically symmetric, although it may not be. You know, after we get a few, we'll be able to tell. But is there anything in this time delay business that you could do such a thing?
I think what you're asking is, does it matter whether the stuff comes from deep in the neutron star or in the neutron star crust? And the answer is not really. I think Stephen Rosswog has done simulations where he's begun with material in the crust already, you know, where the nuclei are starting from here, say, and as opposed to matter that doesn't even have nuclei that are at much higher densities. And the same thing happens to both. I mean, you get some differences in the production of the elements, but they're small compared to the general characteristics that they are our process elements produced with peaks, in the right ranges. So it doesn't seem to matter where the material comes from, as long as it's neutron rich to start, very neutron rich to start. So if you start with material at the very outside of the crust, where you have it's not iron, but maybe, you know, twice as heavy as iron, but proton fractions of close to a half, 0.4, then you're not going to make our process material with that stuff. So the stuff from the very outside is going to make nuclei between iron and rubidium or the beginning of the R process.
There's almost no mass there.
But there's almost no mass there, yeah.
Way smaller.
Yeah. But it seems like the stuff that's making the blue ejecta contains only first R process peak, elements up to the first R process peak. And this has been one of the problems with supernova simulations, is that they do tend, you can make the first R process peak, I think, more easily in supernova than the all three peaks. So the idea that maybe there's two sources of the R process, one producing the first peak and then the other one producing all three peaks, or the second two peaks, that could come from mergers. So that's sort of where people have put it. But now that we see that all three peaks can be produced, because there's such a different character in the composition and temperature density history of different parts of the neutron, of the material that comes out, that you apparently can do all of the R process in the right way. So,
more questions for Jim?
I just wanted to comment, Ben's right that you can hold on to ejecta if it shocks and you're in the set-off phase, but it seems in an ultra-faint galaxy, supernova just blow their way out, unless they're in some dense region. So maybe it does point to a prompt formation channel for the neutron star mergers in the ultra-faint galaxies. Yeah. They can't be way out there, although they'll just blow everything out. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.